And now, from the Green 960 studios in San Francisco, this is An Organic Conversation with Helga Hellberg.
Hello and welcome to An Organic Conversation. I'm your host, Helga Hellberg. I hope you had a great week. Many people responded to last week's show about the varieties of fruit that we actually tasted here in the studio. The show is called For the Love of Produce, and you can find it now even on iTunes as a podcast, as well as on anorganicconversation.com if you want to listen to it. And several people requested more information about the varieties of fruit that we tasted. So we are in the process of uploading helpful links about each show onto our show archive. So for any further information, very soon you'll find all that at anorganicconversation.com. Welcome again. On a walk this week with my dog, I realized that change is in the air. And not that that's a new thought, but, you know, once in a while when we pay attention, it becomes an experience. And there was a sense of, dare I say it, fall in the air. So don't get me wrong. I don't want to create any kind of overwhelm here. And I know we're just heading into the summer, and I'm the greatest critic when it comes to, you know, Christmas decoration in department stores in late October every year. And yet, in this case, I could swear I felt a tad of fall this week. Maybe it was the light, which right now, as we're heading into summer solstice tomorrow, is as golden in the morning as it gets. It was incredible. It was very early, and the light just had a clarity to it that was rare. Maybe it was the wind and the way it made some dry leaves shuffle against each other. And maybe it was just my memory. Maybe I remembered these days, and somewhere deep down I knew that summer is right here, right now, and that after the summer, fall will come. I was reminded of the seasons of this year, of time passing, the celebration of what is yet to come this year, the harvest, the bounty, the flavors of 09, the progression from spring to summer, from seed to carrot, from caterpillar to butterfly, from boy to man, and from summer to fall. And it is such an interesting little struggle. In my anticipation for the opening of the Point Reyes Farmers Market next week, I can also hear a tiny voice in my heart that says, no, please don't let that day ever come. Because that day will also be the beginning of the end of the season. So as we are seeing tomatoes and summer squashes ripen and boys graduate and girls become women and dogs get older, I'm walking into this season with a somber sense of gratitude for the seeds that have become our food, for the grapes that will soon be wine, and for the courage to accept this flow, this beauty, and that we can't do anything about it, that it's just the way life is. A good friend of mine sent me the following little article. Why do leaves burst into color exactly? It's a sort of magic trick. A sleight of leaf maneuver in which the tree, sensing impending autumn, yanks the green from the leaf, thereby exposing the leaf's true color. The real color of deciduous trees are the ones you see in autumn. Spring and summer are one long green disguise, a cacophony of chlorophyll. So the beauty, the color of fall, is not something that happens to the leaf, but is a revelation of what has always been. Just as the leaf, the carrot, the boy or the girl, life is about expressing your true innermost beauty, which is always inside of us. May this year's harvest be abundant and full of wisdom. You're listening to An Organic Conversation, and we'll be right back after the break. Thank you.
inside of my world. Machines just like a maze, where all of the walls are continually changed. And I've done all I can to stand on the steps with my heart in my hand. Now I'm starting to see, maybe it's got nothing to do with me. Fathers, be good to your daughters. Daughters will love like you do. Girls, become lovers who turn into mothers. So mothers, be good to your daughters.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. Welcome again. Today, my guest is Tom Stubbs, owner of incredibly beautiful Stubbs Vineyards in Petaluma, California. And we will be diving into the magic world of growing and making wine. But first, as always, here's Dan McGovern with the news.
This is Sustainable Food News, your weekly news service on An Organic Conversation. I'm Dan McGovern. The American Medical Association has approved a new policy to develop a healthy and ecologically sustainable food chain within the U.S. healthcare system. The nation's largest physician organization convened for its annual meeting in Chicago earlier this week, with President Obama delivering the keynote speech on healthcare reform. The new resolution calls for the AMA to work with healthcare groups in educating the industry and the public about the importance of consuming food and beverages of naturally high nutritional quality. The group blamed the current U.S. industrial food system for producing too much processed, calorie-dense foods instead of the fruits, vegetables, and whole grains recommended by the government's own dietary guidelines for Americans. Noting a clear connection between a healthy diet and optimal health, the AMA said medical schools and healthcare facilities are uniquely qualified to take a lead role in fulfilling the new policy. The United States and Canada on Wednesday signed an organic equivalency agreement to facilitate the flow of certified organic goods between the two countries. Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, told a standing-room-only crowd at the All Things Organic Trade Show in Chicago this week that the agreement between the world's two largest organic trading partners is an important first step towards global harmonization of organic standards. The market for organic products in Canada is valued at an estimated $2.6 billion. U.S. organic sales totaled $24.6 billion last year. The vast majority of Canadian organic products already meet USDA organic guidelines. Still, the U.S. will maintain certain restrictions on imports of Canadian organic foods that don't follow U.S. standards, such as Canadian organic dairy products that used antibiotics in their production. On the flip side, Canada said it will continue to prohibit exports of hydroponically grown organic products from the United States. Canada's new organic standards go into effect June 30th. A new report released Monday by the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows direct-to-consumer farm sales are growing faster than total agricultural sales. Direct-to-consumer farm sales, which include farm stands, farmers markets, and community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, increased 105% from 1997 to 2007. Total ag sales grew just 48% during the 10-year period. Since 1997, nine states have consistently appeared on the list of top 10 states in terms of overall direct marketing sales volume. However, there have been some shifts in market share over the 10-year period, with Texas, Wisconsin, and Massachusetts moving down in ranking, while Washington and New York have moved up. All six New England states are on the list of top 10 states in terms of overall direct marketing sales volume. And farms with annual direct-to-consumer sales below 5,000 captured 12% of the direct marketing sales, while representing 77% of farmers engaged in direct marketing. This is Sustainable Food News, your weekly news service on An Organic Conversation. I'm Dan McGovern.
Thank you, Dan, and what a treat. Your voice is so beautiful. How come? because you're here in the studio.
In San Francisco, on the West Coast.
Yes, usually on the phone, but today live here in the studio. Welcome, Dan. Lots of good news there. So let's talk about the AMA, American Medical Association, endorsing now naturally high, what's the exact term? Naturally high
nutritional? Naturally high nutritional quality, yeah.
Do we know what that group defines? That set of foods?
Well, I think what they're putting the emphasis on is whole foods, fresh whole foods, fruits and vegetables, whole grains, the kind of unprocessed foods that contribute to a healthy lifestyle.
And do we know concretely what they are proposing yet, or is that to come?
That's to come. This is in development. They do want to make this system-wide through the supply chain. However, there are lots of barriers to simply implementing this. One of the biggest barriers is the group purchasing organizations, which hospitals have to go through. Probably about 95% use these group purchasing bodies to get their food. So instituting change within those structures is going to take a little bit of time. But now that we have a policy, I think we're in the right direction.
And do we know if that's just the food served in hospitals, or will it go as far as advising people on a healthy diet, on healthy nutrition as a treatment?
Sure, yeah. This is going to be an all-encompassing view of change in the supply chain. Not only the hospitals and what the patients are eating, but also what the cafeterias are serving, what their catering operations are doing. But the AMA wants to work with you know, public organizations. They want to work with the healthcare industry. So it's not just a strict what the doctors are doing in their own hospitals at all. No.
Interesting the timing that this comes at the heels of President Obama announcing a drastic healthcare reform. So that's beautiful. I know that doctors have about a day or two within their 4 years of studies of becoming doctors, that is actually focused on nutrition itself. It's about 8 hours, or 10 hours. And I know that Hippocrates said that the doctors of tomorrow have to be nutritionists, or let our food be the medicine. So this is a beautiful, beautiful development, which also goes hand in hand with more localized food systems. You had a report on direct farm sales.
Yes. Yeah, we're seeing it's a real sea change in how people are going about looking at their food that they're eating, and more people are looking to connect to the people that are producing their food. I think that's why you're seeing this explosion of farmers markets and CSAs and people belonging to CSAs. They want that connection. They want to know who's producing my food and getting that, you know, a little bit closer to the soil where it comes from, rather than the processed foods on the supermarket shelves.
Yes, and we are looking at farmers markets all day for the entire hour next Saturday, next Saturday's show. So please tune in again then. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thanks,
Dan McGovern, Sustainable Food News. Just stick around here. It's great to have you here live. Tom, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Besides wine, you also produce grapes. Are you selling your grapes at farmers markets, or what is your direct? Are you
No.
part of that direct marketing, farm to sale?
Well, we're very much reliant on direct consumer sales, but not of grapes. Our grapes are not table grapes. They're really cloned and designed to be made into wine. And so although we sell about 90% of our wine locally within a probably 30 or 40 mile radius, and we're small enough to be able to do that. The grapes are edible, but they're very tiny, very small. They have a very high skin to fruit ratio, and so they wouldn't do well as table grapes, although they're tasty for a little while, right before harvest.
They are tasty, yes. I remember, I think it was last year, when I visited your farm, I need to ask, is it called cluster of grapes? No,
yeah.
You said bunch, a bunch of grapes.
We usually say cluster.
Okay. I had an entire cluster of Pinot Noir grapes picked off the vine, and you encouraged me to just bite into it, not pick the individual grapes, but just bite into it. And it was unbelievable. So the because of their size, isn't it true that that ups the sugar and that's why they're so good?
Well, the size, winemakers love tiny berries because the what is really important, particularly for the Pinot Noir, is to have a high ratio of skin to fruit.
You want the skin.
They want the skin. I mean, the skin stays in with the juice for a few weeks, and that's where you get a lot of the complexity and flavors and tannins. And so, generally speaking, high quality wine grapes, the smaller the berries, the better.
Yeah, skin is underrated. I agree. Skin is wonderful. And so you sell your wine within a 30-mile radius, you said? Is that correct?
I'd say about 90% of it. We're a very small producer. We make, on average, about 1,000 cases a year. And because we have a strong, loyal, local following, we don't generally need to go out of state. And so our goal, typically, is to sell as much as we can, ideally everything, to local restaurants and individuals, which is our direct-to-consumer business.
So how did you get into this? Why would one become a wine grower? You are from England. Actually, you just got back from England again yesterday.
Yes.
Do you still have family there?
I have family there, and I actually come from five generations of English farmers.
Obviously not wine.
Not wine, no. Although, interestingly, wine growing is growing in England, in the south, probably because of global warming. England's now warm enough to grow grapes, whereas 50 years ago it wasn't. But that's another subject.
And what's France thinking about that?
France isn't happy. the last thing they need is competition from across the channel. They're already getting enough.
They would love that.
Yeah, they're getting enough from Australia. Now it's coming in from England. So they're getting it from all sides. Like a lot of people in the wine business, I kind of stumbled into it by accident. I bought the property in West Marin in 1982 with a view to living there. And my wife, Mary, and I decided that we wanted to do something on the land that was economically sustainable, a living, rather than just live there and enjoy the scenery. So in 1996, we planted 11 acres of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay grapes. And that evolved into a winemaking operation.
And you're still looking for that economic sustainability.
Yes, that elusive sustainability.
I can only imagine that where are you with that? How it's I don't think, whether you have 1 acre or 30 acres, it's on that scale, it's really hard to make a living. And the quality is so exceptional that does it really pay off?
Sustainability is always just out of reach around the next corner. And we keep visualizing ourselves one day making money or enough money to retire on. But the truth is, we're so small that we don't have economies of scale. We have to pay always top price for our glass, for our foils, for our corks, even for our labor, because everything we do is on a minute scale. If you compare us with someone like a Kendall Jackson, who's making 3 million cases a year, you can imagine that they're not paying as much for corks as we are.
Per bottle. Right,
right. Right.
And so you're making 1,000 cases.
Yeah, actually, what we make varies dramatically from year to year. Our average is 1,000. And the reason it varies is that we're totally dependent on our own crop. And that crop varies fairly significantly depending on the microclimate of the given year. For example, in 06, we had a bumper crop of about 40 tons, which translates to over 2,000 cases. And then 2 years later in 08, we hardly had anything at all because we were virtually wiped out by frost. And so we're very much dependent on the vicissitudes of the climate, like most farmers.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. My guest today is Tom Stubbs of Stubbs Vineyards, and we'll be right back after this break.
I'm An Organic Conversation is brought to you by Svatica Skincare. Founded by Janet Lee Katzen, Svatica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Svatica skincare products and the Svatica Spa, visit svatica.com. That's SPHATIKA.com.
Hi, I'm Peter Walsh. My wife and I founded Manika Jewelry with the intention to offer a different kind of jewelry. Beautiful, made by local Bay Area artists, and without a social or environmental compromise. Our featured designers use reclaimed precious metals and Kimberly certified gemstones. It's jewelry made with heart and soul. Come visit our store just off Union Square at 11 Maiden Lane in San Francisco, or visit our website at manikajewelry.com.
Frye Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frye never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frye organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frye Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
Sustainable Food News is the premier source of daily news and market information for the organic, sustainable, and natural food industries. Headline after headline, Sustainable Food News reports on a profound shift in food buying habits as more and more people begin to understand the impact of their purchases on the environment and communities around the world. Join Dan McGovern, publisher of Sustainable Food News, every Saturday morning on An Organic Conversation. For more information, visit www.sustainablefoodnews.com.
And we are back here at An Organic Conversation on Green 960. I'm Helge Hellberg, and I'm speaking today with Tom Stubbs of Stubbs Vineyards, an organic vineyard in West Marin, California. And also here in the studio as a special treat is Dan McGovern from Sustainable Food News. Dan, have you ever had Tom's wine?
I have not.
Didn't we drink that in at Jesse Cool's place a while ago?
I don't know if that was that.
Yeah.
Was that the kind?
Anyway, we can't, because of FCC regulations, have wine here, but I'm sure we'll, we'll sample some after
tonight.
The show.
For sure.
Tonight, that's right. Tom, what is your chance to influence the harvest? Like we are now in June, just about at the end soon. Are you tasting the grapes every 3 weeks and you know what's missing, and how can you steer the process, or is it completely off your hands?
It's almost all we can do is influence the long-term health of the soil and the vines themselves. But in terms of influencing an individual harvest in a given year, that's virtually impossible.
So there's no feeding going on of any kind during the season. There's no once they grow, they grow.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly, to your question about tasting, there's really, at this point in the year, there's nothing to taste. The berries are just absolutely tiny. And in fact, they're very tart, very bitter, until right before harvest. We feed the soil in the fall with organic compost, manure, etc. And we do apply some foliar feeding sprays, some organic food that actually is ingested by the vines through the leaves.
Like what, for example?
Like iron, boron. We test the leaves and petioles at about this time of year.
Oh.
Send them to a lab. They tell us what they might be lacking, and then we add that. And the great thing is, with the growth of the organic movement, there are more and more OMRI certified products that we're allowed to use.
What is OMRI, people?
I can't remember, but it's the entity. It's an acronym for the entity that decides whether the products we want to use are permissible to retain our organic certification.
OMRI stands for Organic Material Research Institute, and it's a nonprofit that independently tests products and then lists them as organic or not, just for clarification. So you're saying they're OMRI approved materials that you can that you can feed the plant with. So you're not trying the grapes, but you are sending in the leaves.
Yes.
And determine what's missing and then adjust somewhat.
Exactly.
And you always keep saying that the most important part of the vineyard is the soil and the most important part of winemaking is the grape. Can you expand on that? What do you...
Yeah, well, the people ask me, where is your wine made? Because we actually don't have a winery on site. And my response is always that the wine is made in the vineyard, and that the, I think it was Andrei Celeschev who said that the most important thing is to see the winemaker's footprints in the vineyard itself, because the winemaker doesn't just operate in a lab, in a building. He needs to be there in the vineyard nurturing those grapes. So I'm not technically a winemaker. I'm a farmer, but I think that we put a lot of emphasis on soil quality, soil health, and vineyard health, and hopefully that shows up in the wine. It's a bit of a cliche, but you can't make good wine out of bad fruit. You can take really great fruit and screw it up, but you can't do it the other way around.
Tom, I got a question for you. You're the only certified organic grape grower in Marin County.
That's correct.
How difficult is that for you? I mean, being so close to the coast versus Sonoma and Napa, which is a little further inland, it must be real. Is it a lot more difficult to maintain that?
It's a lot much cooler climate, and so we're limited to the types of grapes we can grow. Pretty much Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are the only grapes that we can grow economically in our cool climate. So that's one thing.
So the climate defines which varieties you can grow.
Right.
Pinot Noir like to shiver a little.
Exactly.
Grapes. And inland, you couldn't grow a Pinot Noir necessarily.
You could grow it, but it wouldn't be of a super high quality. Huh. And if you look at the Pinot Noir areas in this country, they're all cool. They're the Central Coast, Oregon, and Sonoma Coast and Marin County. They're pretty much limited to those cooler climates.
And so is that the only variety that's grown in cooler climates and then everything else is in hotter weather?
You know, I'm not an expert, but certainly Cabernet, for example, we could grow a Cabernet in Marin County, but it just wouldn't taste as good. We would never be able to compete with Napa, which is on a given day, Napa is significantly hotter than we are. And so that Napa lends itself to Cabernet and Merlot. We lend ourselves to Chardonnay and Pinot.
So even though you grew up in a family of farmers, there was no wine grower, and you were, before you bought that property and planted grapes, you were in a completely different job as well, right?
Yes.
You were in real estate.
Yeah. And really, I learned on the job. In fact, my wife, Mary, supervised the planting of the vineyard.
So how did you learn what to plant? How do you know that that's a cool climate and it's good for Pinot Noir? And
there's an army of expensive consultants out there that you hire, and they separate you very quickly from your money and give you varying levels of advice. But you can buy that know-how. And over time and working with these different people, I've picked up a little bit of on-the-job training. And interestingly, what I've learned... which you almost have to go through to believe it, is that growing grapes and making great wine in this part of the world isn't that hard. The hard part of the business is always the marketing. And that's where most people fall down, is they think they're going to make a great wine and it's just going to fly off the shelves. But the truth is that we're competing with something like 400 or 500 other brands locally within about 40 miles from Napa and Sonoma. So it's a terrifically crowded marketplace.
Are you finding that your organic label, though, is giving you the edge?
It's a big plus. And we didn't know that going into it. We actually switched to organic farming really for philosophical reasons and had no idea what the economic impact would be. But what we found is that there's a tremendous loyalty locally in Marin and San Francisco to people who are prepared to walk the walk and farm organically. And we have terrific relationships with people like Chez Panisse and Slanted Door and Nopa, who, you know, they're committed to buying local organically grown food, and they like what we do because they know that you know, that we have a reasonably ethical approach to farming. So that's been the economic benefit to us. You can't translate it to price, but you could certainly translate it to higher sales and local sales. I'd far rather be selling my wine locally than shipping it across the country or even the world.
Which is so interesting because I would say nowadays it is for the price premium that draws people into the organic and sustainable world. Not that, you know, their heart is not there, of course, but there's an attraction in making a little bit more money out of farming, which is hard enough to begin with. In your case, it was truly driven by your understanding of ecology and your desire to be sustainable, and now you get the perk after.
I think that's actually what happened. We just had no idea because there was no market evidence that we would either sell our grapes for more money or sell the wine that we produced for more money.
So you said earlier, you said a word, you said clone, and clone could have the association to something genetically engineered. Can you expand that further just to clarify how does it work? Where did you buy your stock, your wine stock?
Well, when you plant a vineyard, you buy rootstock, and
from where? Like you go
from a professional grower, and they will advise you, or people will advise you on a particular rootstock to plant in a particular climate. And in fact, I think it's one of the reasons why wine growing is starting to expand in Marin is that over the last few years, there have been developments of rootstocks that will survive and thrive in cooler climates that before didn't exist. So whether that comes under the heading of genetic engineering or not, I don't know.
Right, but when you say clone, it's like it's a hybrid in the sense of very, very old varieties have been crossed basically,
yes,
to create a variety that's a little bit more cold weather resistant,
yeah,
or
yeah,
naturally crossed.
Exactly. To take the qualities of that particular plant that will do better in a cooler climate.
So how many Pinot Noir varieties are there?
Oh, literally hundreds. And it's an area, it's a highly technical area that I'm not really qualified to talk about.
Yeah, and it's important to know that genetically modified isn't allowed anywhere in organic production whatsoever by law. But regarding the marketing and you know, giving you that edge with organic, what are your thoughts on biodynamic, the agriculture principles based on Rudolf Steiner? That would even take it that level higher. What's the trade-off that you would or would not go after that?
My thoughts on that are that it's my life is complicated enough being an organic farmer, and that I'm not really ready to go to the next level. I admire people who do, take my hat off to them, but it's not for me at this point.
Yeah. And as far as the biodiversity of your operation, I know I visited wineries up and down the coast here that or vineyards rather that you know, it's all, you know, you have to look at everything, the birds, the animals that are there. You know, there's things like the salmon safe label for vineyards that are near streams to make sure that, you know, there's no runoff or anything that's going to harm salmon in rivers. What are some of the more sustainable practices that you have on your farm other than just, you know, following the organic law?
Well, you know, one of the, probably the biggest single difference between us and a conventional farmer is that we don't use Roundup, and Roundup is a product that you don't appreciate it until you stop using it. And the bottom line is that because of that, weed control is a huge issue for us. It requires just an awful lot of labor, a lot of it by hand. And so the biggest part, the biggest component of our biodiversity is that we have a lot more weeds than most people. But we do things like we encourage owls to nest. We have owl nest boxes because owls will kill gophers. Obviously, the lack of chemicals in the vineyard means that we have a lot of beneficial insects, and we plant a cover crop so that we get a lot of beautiful flowers in the spring. It is a very biodiverse place.
So you are completely off the grid as well.
Our house is off the grid. Our house is about a mile and a half from the nearest power line. And we built the house, actually Mary and I built the house ourselves about 15 years ago. And at the time we were on a real budget, and bringing power into the house over a mile and a half of rough country was going to be extremely expensive.
And you were living in a wheelbarrow actually, right? Tell us the story.
Well, we started out, oddly enough, living in a wine tank. We had a 13,000 gallon wine tank. Made of redwood, which originally came from Italian Swiss colony.
Obviously empty.
And we turned it into a little house where we lived for several years.
How big is a wine tank?
Well,
just to give a visual.
It's about 150 square feet. And when the family got to be four people, we figured that that square footage, in fact, they weren't even square feet, they were round feet. it wasn't big enough for the four of us. And that's right around the time when the house was completed. But we still have the wine tank, and it's now home to my pigeon collection.
And so when the house was completed, you couldn't run the power line, it was too expensive.
Well, that was when we were building the house. We elected not to bring power to the house. So now we have a combination of a small wind turbine, a 1 kW wind turbine, and solar panels. And so we get the sun during the day and backup from the wind turbine, which goes pretty much 24/7 when the wind is blowing.
And that powers I'm sure you need to have pump irrigation for the vineyard, or how's the vineyard powered?
Well, the vineyard is about a mile away from the house, and on the edge of the property, power actually does come to, not right to the vineyard, but close enough that we can run an irrigation pump. So that's the only time where we meet the grid is on the edge of the property. And it would be hard to imagine irrigating those 11,000 vines without a pump.
So being out there in rural West Marin, kind of off the grid, integrating nature as best as you can, but at the same time, depending on her and trusting that everything will turn out at the end. What are your experiences out there? It sounds so romantic and beautiful, and having seen the property myself and visited several times, it's stunning, and I'm sure it's not quite that easy.
No, I mean, I think it brings to mind, the difference between solitude and isolation. we moved there, or I bought the property because I love the solitude, but I remember coming home from work one night at dusk and to the sight of Mary shooting at a raccoon from the hip with a Winchester in the fading light, and the raccoon had got into the house and was threatening the kids. And of course, at this point, the kids were cowering behind the furniture, and it wasn't the raccoon they were frightened of; it was Mary and the Winchester. And so that to me was more of an issue of isolation rather than solitude, and it had a sort of faintly Appalachian ring to it.
And so did she take care of it? Or
Actually, no, I took care of it.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. I'm Helge Hellberg, and I'm speaking with Tom Stubbs, and also in the studio is Dan McGovern. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. I won't let you down.
An Organic Conversation is brought to you by Svatica Skincare. Founded by Janet Lee Katzen, Svatica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Svatica skincare products and the Svatica Spa, visit svatica.com. That's Svatica.com.
Hi, I'm Peter Walsh. My wife and I founded Manika Jewelry with the intention to offer a different kind of jewelry. Beautiful, made by local Bay Area artists, and without a social or environmental compromise. Our featured designers use reclaimed precious metals and Kimberly certified gemstones. It's jewelry made with heart and soul. Come visit our store just off Union Square at 11 Maiden Lane in San Francisco, or visit our website at manikajewelry.com.
Frye Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frye never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frye organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frye Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites, available at grocery stores and online at fryewine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
Sustainable Food News is the premier source of daily news and market information for the organic, sustainable, and natural food industries. Headline after headline, Sustainable Food News reports on a profound shift in food buying habits as more and more people begin to understand the impact of their purchases on the environment and communities around the world. Join Dan McGovern, publisher of Sustainable Food News, every Saturday morning on An Organic Conversation. For more information, visit www.sustainablefoodnews.com.
And we are back to An Organic Conversation, talking about wine today with wine grower Tom Stubbs of Stubbs Vineyards. Tom, during the break, we talked about organic wine versus organic vineyard. Your vineyard is certified organic, your wine is not. What's the difference? Why?
The difference is that winemakers generally use products in the winery, particularly sulfites, to prevent mildew in the barrel that would essentially decertify us. And there's also a market reason that we don't attempt to make organic wine, and that is that it hasn't had great acceptance in the marketplace, and our business is tough enough as it is, and so we're content to make our organically grown fruit and organically certified fruit, and then let the winemaker do his thing in the winery.
Yeah, it seems very hard. And I know in the early attempts to make really good certified organic wine as the end product, there were some wines that didn't quite meet the palate or the quality standards that people were used to. And so it had kind of a bad rep.
Yeah.
And we know, you know, now one of my underwriters is Frye Vineyards. It's a completely certified organic and biodynamic product that is wonderful. And there's La Rocca Vineyards, but it's only a selected few that have gone that route.
Yeah.
And just to clarify that, where can people buy your wine? Do you have, can people just come by? Do you have a...
We're not open to the public. We don't have that kind of license, but we have a website, stubbsvineyard.com, where you can buy the wine directly from us.
And do you have a wine club too?
We do have a wine club.
What does that mean?
Like
what?
Well, it means that we ship a certain number of bottles to you each year and guarantee you a discount. And so it's our way of getting our consumers a little closer to us. And it's at this point, it's a relatively small part of our business, but it's growing.
And they... get invited maybe a couple times a year or so to visit the...
We have events and private tastings for club members.
Because that's really exceptional to see the rolling landscape. I mean, you're in one of the most beautiful parts.
It is a pretty part of the country.
How have you changed working in this part of the... I mean, you're from England. You just got back. The culture is very different. How have you been able to integrate that Britishness of you? And now going back, how has that landscape changed you?
Well, I'd like to be able to say that it's made me a much calmer, saner person. But with 3 kids and an active business that's run on the property, I have to say that our lives are pretty hectic. And one of the things that I didn't consider when I bought the property and we moved up there is that kids have to get to school. And they have to be taken to school by their parents. We don't have buses out there. So our lives are pretty full with the normal kid stuff, and that's actually magnified by the fact that we're quite a long way from the population centers.
So you run your family, you're a father, and there's Father's Day tomorrow. You work in the vineyard every day? Is that
Not every day. There are times of the year where the vines just aren't doing anything, like right after harvest. Once we're done with harvest and tending to the soil with compost and manure, etc., there's not a whole lot that goes on in November, December, January. And January we start again with pruning, and that's really the beginning of the year.
So the vineyard rests for the winter.
It rests, and even when it's growing, there are periods where there's just not a whole lot to do. You're just waiting for it to grow. And that's actually, to me, one of the appealing things is it's easier managing grapevines than it is animals. Animals need constant attention.
What's the most satisfying part of what you do? What have you found?
I really, a couple of things. I think being outside all the time, I love. But I must admit, from an ego standpoint, I get a great deal of satisfaction from the accolades that we get from our friends and customers. People really, really appreciate the wine. And that's what keeps me going. I love that.
And again, it's Pinot Noir, but you also make a Chardonnay.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is usually more in slightly warmer climates. How do they both do next to each other?
They both do well because we chose the right rootstock, I think, for that particular microclimate. And the soil's good. The climate's really cool. We get the cool, foggy nights, even in the height of summer. So those two particular varieties have done very well for us.
So it's almost like a little Midsummer Night's Dream out there.
Well, it will be.
with the fog coming in. And, I mean, you can see photos on your website, I believe. Yes,
yeah.
Actually, spectacular photos. The website is... stepsvineyard.com. And so you have hot days, you have foggy days, you have overcast in the morning, burning off rolling hills, a gorgeous landscape, and then nestled in that valley, how many acres?
11 acres planted.
In total?
Yeah.
Yeah, 2 different varieties of grapes. It seems extremely romantic, and yes, tomorrow is the beginning of summer. And since you're British, I brought you a little piece from A Midsummer Night's Dream from Shakespeare. And I tried to read it, and I just struggled so hard. Can we have a taste of that?
Absolutely. This is Hermia and A Midsummer Night's Dream. And in the wood, where often you and I, upon faint primrose beds, were wont to lie, emptying our bosoms of their counsel sweet, there my Lysander and myself shall meet, and thence from Athens turn away our eyes, to seek new friends and stranger companies. Farewell, sweet playfellow, pray thou for us, and good luck grant thee thy Demetrius. Keep word, Lysander, we must starve our sight, from lover's food till morrow deep midnight.
Thank you. So do you miss England?
You know, England is... is where I'm from. My family lives there, but but I couldn't ever imagine living there. I've been gone for so long. I left in 1975, and I have put down roots, literally and figuratively, here that I'm never going to leave. And it's still relatively accessible by plane. San Francisco, London is still outrageously cheap, and so I get over there to see my family two or three times a year, and that's all I need. Love England, but I don't miss it.
And so I know you're 30 years away from retirement, but what's the plan for the operation? You can't really grow more grapes. You can't really up your production.
We could grow more grapes, but I'm not sure that I have the financial capacity. It's an expensive operation, requires a lot of capital. And Mary and I are already working pretty hard on this business, and I'm just not sure that we want to work any harder than we're doing. So we're probably going to keep it at the size we are today, and we're probably going to keep producing whatever fruit we're able to gain from that particular site. And we're going to have good years and bad years. But fortunately, wine doesn't have to be sold. It's not like lettuces. It doesn't have to be sold that week. It keeps pretty well for a few years. And so we can control our sales through the warehouse and inventory.
And luckily that helps you, I'm sure, to weather economically hard times. You had a record crop a couple of years ago, and then last year you didn't have the water to sprinkle the grapes in spring, and then the frost came and it killed the flowers. Can you explain what happened there?
Well,
and what would you have done if you had water?
Yeah, basically the site is in a valley, and it turns out to have been a pretty good site with one exception, and that is a valley is always susceptible to frost. Frost is heavier than air. And so that it tends to settle in the valleys. And the typical frost protection system that we would use today involves water, spraying a fine mist on the vines so that it actually, interestingly, it freezes around the buds, and that little thin layer of ice protects it from going below
freezing. It's like an igloo, right?
Yeah, exactly, just like an igloo. But we just don't have that capacity because we don't have enough water. And so every now and again, and I hope it isn't too often, we're going to get frost. That's just part of farming. Fortunately, we've been there since 96 and we've had one frost. So that's a ratio I can live with. I just don't want to deal with it every year.
And yes, Dan.
Well, I just kind of a different part of the subject. I just want to kind of chime in here again. I'm feeling a little frustrated by the dynamic that we were talking about with organic wine, and how, you know, if they're, you know, your vineyard is organic, but the end product isn't. And we're knowing this because you're telling me this, but I wouldn't know that by just buying if I didn't know who you were and I bought a bottle of your wine, would I know that you grew your grapes organically?
It would say that on the label. It does say that on the label.
It does. Okay. Yeah. It's just, it seems, I know 20 bottles of wine a year probably delivered to me from organic vintners here in the Bay Area. They're all organic, is very widely displayed on the label. And so there seems to be, is there a disconnect between the field and the store? I mean, as far as selling organic wine, I mean, it seems like a barrier here to getting more organic wine sold.
I think it has been, as Helga said, it has been a barrier because in the past, maybe 20, 30 years ago, there were a lot of organic wines in the market that just flat didn't taste that good. And I think they got a bad rap in the marketplace. And I don't feel like I'm big enough or powerful enough in the market to try and change that dynamic. So I've just, and also I'm in love with my own particular winemaker, Dan Goldfield. And I don't think Dan has much interest in making organic wine. So since 90% of wine quality has to do with the fruit itself, I'm satisfied that we're doing the right thing by growing our fruit organically. And I don't feel a need to go all the way and produce organic wine.
So Dutton Goldfield is getting this exceptional grape from you.
Yes.
And what does he do with that? What's the, do you know the process of roughly of what happens to the grape after you grew it?
Well, on the surface, it's very simple. It actually varies between the Pinot Noir and the Chardonnay. And bear in mind, I'm a complete amateur in this regard. But the wine is fermented for about 10 days with, this is the Pinot, with the skins. And then the juice is drained off. And at this point, it's the sugar has turned to alcohol, drained off, and it sits in very expensive oak barrels for about 12 months. We buy all of our oak from France. And the oak is part of the complexity, part of the flavor. And after that, it goes from barrel to bottle and sits for another few months, and then it's ready to sell.
It sounds so easy.
It sounds easy. And of course, Dan would shoot me because it's a lot more complicated than that. But that's a layman's version of what happens in the winery. I'm essentially trying to simplify what he does so it makes what I do look more important.
And is he happy with your grapes?
Dan's very loyal. Actually, he is really been the main pioneer of putting Marin County on the map as a respected wine-growing region. And when Dan was with Schramsberg and Kendall Jackson before he had his own operation, and he was sourcing grapes. This was even before we planted in 96. He was sourcing grapes from little hidden away vineyards and then marketing them under the Kendall Jackson label.
Mixing them together?
No, not necessarily. Sometimes he was doing single vineyard designated wines. But he's always been a fan of Marin. And so because he's now a name in his own right, he's done a great job of helping put us on the map and getting us taken seriously in the marketplace.
So amazing grapes and a really, really exceptional winemaker make Stubbs wine, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, that beautiful. Are you happy with it? I mean, of course.
I'm very happy with it. It actually has gone beyond all of our expectations. Interestingly, we started out as grape growers, and our business plan, such as it was simply to grow grapes and sell them to other wineries. And then in, I guess it was 2002, there was a little bit of a glut on the market, and we were having trouble selling all of our grapes. We had a couple of tons left over, and we sent them up to Dan and said, make some wine, and we'll see how it tastes. And it turned out to be really good, and it sold very well. And that's when we started to think that maybe we could be winemakers as opposed to just grape growers.
I'm so glad you did. Tom Stubbs from Stubbs Vineyard, my guest today. Thanks for coming in, Tom. Good pleasure to have you.
Happy to be here.
Thanks, Dan, for being around as well. That was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. An Organic Conversation is produced by Jen Lloyd. Production assistant is Kristen O'Heary. Underwriting production provided by Mark Van Gelder. Music production by Terrence Smith. Thank you all, and also always thanks here to the team at Green 960, Chelsea Mauck, Mark McNown, John Scott, and John Plessis. And of course, thank you, our listeners, for being part of this show and for actually listening. We love to hear from you. Please send us your comments and questions to hyperlink at share@anorganicconversation.com. Again, that's share@anorganicconversation.com. And please tune again next week when we'll be celebrating farmers markets with live reportages from markets from the Bay Area. Thank you also always to the feminine and the masculine in this world, to all moms and dads, especially tomorrow on Father's Day. For podcasts and for more information, please visit our website at An Organic Conversation. And podcasts are also available on iTunes. Coming up next is the Gavin Newsom Show. Please stay put. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg. Have a great weekend, and thanks again for listening to An Organic Conversation here at Green 960.